Last week, the US State Department's envoy for global health security was in Australia to discuss the biological threats to public health from accidental and deliberate release of modified bacteria and viruses. Dr. Michael Osterholm is director of the Centre for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. And I first came across his work decades ago when he explained an epidemic in 431 BC, which had mystified historians for centuries. So, Michael, one of the first things I read of yours was a paper you wrote with another colleague many years ago, which described the plague of Athens as described by Thucydides and tried to get to the bottom of what this plague was. Can you remember that paper?
I sure do. It was during a series of Greek wars, and in one particular point, a very large number of people developed this rash-like illness, very sore throats, and proceeded to die within 1 to 2 days of basically a shock-like syndrome. There were all kinds of explanations, but no one ever really knew. And our work with toxic shock syndrome allowed us to basically tie that together with how many of these soldiers would have died.
Just remind us what toxic shock syndrome is.
Well, toxic shock syndrome really first came to the forefront back in the early 1980 time period when a number of young women in the United States who were having their menstrual periods and then developing this severe rash illness that often led to shock and subsequently they died. The blood vessels just started to leak all the fluid into the body. No one understood exactly why this was happening. It was acute, meaning within 24 to 36 hours, they went from being well to being very sick. And we were able to discover a relationship with the use of tampons during their menstrual period. And it turned out that it was a combination of a newer strain of Staph aureus bacteria that in the presence of oxygen would produce this toxin, which then the toxin led to the shock-like syndrome. And why tampons were important was because back in the early 1980s, there had been a revolution in the manufacturing of fluid-containing materials. And these newer tampons could hold up to 20 times the amount of fluid that the old cotton tampons could hold. But in the process of doing that, they would release a great deal of oxygen into the vagina of the woman, who then, with the presence of the Staph aureus bacteria there, suddenly started making this toxin and developed this illness. The way we tied this back to Thucydides syndrome, we actually
had... Yes, because there were no tampons at the time of Pericles.
That's exactly right. And again, in men too. And the way we tied this back was we also saw some additional cases that were occurring when individuals would have a procedure, particularly a nasal packing procedure where some kind of surgery caused the bacteria in the nose to actually still be exposed to lots of oxygen, but enough to be protected. And then we also saw it when people developed having sore throats. And what would happen is the bacteria would take residence in the sore throat, the damaged tissue, and that was oxygen-rich, obviously, breathing in, and it would produce the toxin. And that's what, in fact, the symptoms that we saw in the people who had the infection secondary to a sore throat, usually caused by a viral illness, was exactly what was described by Thucydides in his syndrome. And so we believe that what happened was the Staph aureus bacteria spread quickly through the troops. Some other kind of infectious disease could have been influenza, could have been any number of things, caused people to have sore throats or damaged tissue in the throat area. The bacteria took up residence, the toxin got produced, and lo and behold, we had a major outbreak that caused so many of these soldiers to die.
Now, many epidemics that we've thought as being new are actually reemergence of old things that have you can find in history. And I think in that paper, you described the possibility that toxic shock syndrome in that epidemic form could come back. Has it ever?
Actually, it hasn't come back in the traditional sense of what we think of with menstrually associated TSS, in part because tampons now, the fluid capacity has been greatly reduced back to what
sure,
it was.
Sure, but the viral thing with
but the viral one, we still get cases. We do occasionally. What we haven't seen is exactly what you just described, that possibility it could be a widespread population-based kind of outbreak where somebody is in a community where there's a lot of viral infections causing sore throats, and at the same time the Staph aureus bacteria gets spread and it produces a toxin. We haven't seen that, but that doesn't mean it couldn't happen tomorrow. So these are the kind of curveballs that we in public health who do what we call disease surveillance, part of our medical detective jobs, are looking for all the time. On any one given day, we have red flags go up any number of places around the world where suddenly people are dying. We don't know why. And the point that you just raised is a good one because one of the things we always think about, could this be a bacterial toxin, a poison produced by a bacteria? And could this be, in fact, the one that caused toxic shock syndrome?
Now, potentially the world is a scary place. You've got emergent I'll use the technical term, coronaviruses. It's a family of viruses, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, SARS, which we remember tends to have disappeared, but MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, affects many people each year, particularly in the Middle East, and has potential fatalities. And you've got stuff going on in laboratories. Talk about this concept, which you've written about, called gain of function.
Well, gain of function is an artificial enhancement of an organism to do something that it wasn't normally genetically programmed to do. One has to understand the world of biology today and what we call synthetic biology, or basically man-made biology. Just take a step back and think about where were we in terms of communication 15 years ago. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have much of the internet. We didn't have any of the kind of modern communication. And in 15 years, look how we've advanced. Well, now take a step aside and look at lab science. Today, we are able to do things in high school laboratories to microorganisms that just 15 to 20 years ago, we were doing only in the most sophisticated government laboratories around the world. And it's because we've developed all these technologies and techniques where we can move genes around, we can edit out genes, we can do all kinds of things to make microbes be different than they were naturally, make them more dangerous, make them more easily to be transmitted. And so we worry a lot about what we call gain of function, meaning that some bad guys may decide one day, instead of using a bullet or a bomb, that they're going to use a germ. You know, we saw that in a very limited way with anthrax in the United States following the 2001 attack. Every day, are mindful that this could easily be used to engineer a germ that's already bad enough the way it is and make it even worse.
Well, let's move the malice to one side for a moment, because you have written about the situations in the lab where people have developed new forms of the virus simply to study the virus, and the worry is that they escape from the lab. Because, I mean, I think the last case of smallpox was as it escaped from the lab in the UK.
Yes. In fact, you're right on the mark with this in terms of what we're concerned about. Let me just quickly give you two examples. One is smallpox. Smallpox, as we know, it was clearly the lion king of infectious diseases along with influenza for most of human history. In the 1900s, right up through the 1940s and 50s, it occurred only infrequently in the world. It still killed 200,000 people a year during those time periods. And so it's a disease that we feared. We were able to eradicate it from the world by the 1970s because, one, it was only a disease of humans. Two, it had very characteristic signs and symptoms. If somebody had smallpox, you knew it because of the horrible, horrible look that they developed with these pox all over their body. And then third, we had a vaccine that we could give to people who were exposed to such people and basically prevent transmission from going any further. Eradicating smallpox was by far the greatest public health victory we've ever achieved. Well, back in the 1980s, late 80s and early 90s, there was a debate. Well, let's just destroy all the remaining smallpox strains that we know exist so that it hopefully will never come back. And there was a big debate that said, well, maybe we don't know where all of them are and we shouldn't destroy them because we may need some for research one day to develop medicines or better vaccines should it return. This debate went on and back and forth, yes, destroy it, no, don't destroy it. And in the end, there was a compromise made that says, well, now that we have the capability to genetically sequence this virus, and this is a very big virus, if you think of, you know, a lot of other viruses, cold viruses, flu viruses, they are kind of like 10-story genetic buildings. Smallpox virus is like a 1,000-story genetic building. It's a huge, huge virus. And at the time, we just had developed the ability to actually sequence something of that size. And so by sequencing, what it meant was it actually laid out the entire genetic roadmap of that virus so that you could actually, with that roadmap, duplicate that virus one day and make it grow. But at the time, we had no technology to do that other than that we just had this historic record. Well, fast forward to now, and in the last 2 years, we've had a research group that has actually taken another very similar virus called horsepox, which does not infect humans, but they use the very same roadmap of sequenced virus of horsepox was then laid out and basically assembled a new virus that was actually infectious from de novo, from start. And the bottom line is we can now do that to smallpox. So could it return one day? Absolutely. And it would be that kind of gain of function issue you talked about where basically someone in a laboratory intends to make smallpox. And even if they don't intend to spread it, if it ever got out, it would be a real challenge and a problem.
And coming back to malice, somebody could develop a form of smallpox that's not amenable to the vaccine.
Absolutely. That is absolutely the case. Now, the second example, which you really referred to in the question, was getting out of the laboratory unintentionally. And there was several groups that wanted to study influenza viruses, and notably the H5N1 virus, which some people will recognize as the old bird flu virus, which killed a number of people in Southeast Asia, then moved into Africa, spread by wild birds, and combined between the poultry and humans, it had been a devastating problem. What we worry about was that virus going to actually further change and not just infect humans, which it was doing from bird exposures, but then allow humans to transmit it to other humans. That's when a pandemic begins, is when humans can transmit the virus to other humans. And they wanted to do research to figure out, well, what are the changes necessary in this virus before it would become a transmissible agent between humans, which is surely a valid scientific question. But we know how easy flu virus is to get transmitted. And in fact, the 1976 H1N1 example, this is another flu virus that suddenly appeared back in 1977-78, related to a release, accidentally, we believe, of the Russian influenza program in 1976. And then it spread around the world. And so we are legitimately concerned, if you're going to do research on these germs, what are the kinds of protections that you have to make sure that they never get out? Because once they're out, they're done. They're gone. You're never going to get the genie back in the bottle. This is a big challenge.
So we'll come to the challenge in a minute, but it's become even easier, and we had a program on this a couple of weeks ago, with CRISPR, this ability to gene edit with high fidelity and change organisms, change the human genome, but also change bacterial and viral genomes. And it's not quite backyard laboratory stuff, but it's not far beyond that. So you don't need a big infrastructure to be able to do it. I know we're going to talk eventually about regulation in this conversation, but is it too late?
I can't say it's too late, but again, we have to understand that even with regulation, which I surely support, is the fact that we have a certain percentage of people in our society who have mental illnesses. These are people who may be very, very bright, very smart. I still maintain as...
Well, you don't need to talk about mental illness. You just need to talk about ISIS recruiting well-educated people who are fundamentalists.
They could do that, absolutely. But I'm actually talking about if you wanted to look at the real risk, I think today, the thousands of life scientists who may have mental illness problems.
So a biological Unabomber.
Exactly. I mean, Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, was by all intents and purposes severely mentally ill, but he could create a hell of a bomb. If you look at the 2001 anthrax attack, we believe that it was the individual who worked at the U.S. government laboratories who was an expert in anthrax who did that. And if you look back in his past, you could see a whole history of mental illness. So whether it's an intentional release because somebody's been recruited into a terrorist group and they have the expertise, or it's because an expert who, for whatever reasons, decides to use this as their weapon of choice, not a bomb or a bullet, we surely have challenges. And you laid out the issues about CRISPR and all the genetic manipulation kinds of things that we can do today to these bugs. We do live in a very, very uncertain time in terms of what can be done to both humans and animals.
A few weeks ago, I chaired a conversation at the World Science Festival in Brisbane where an Australian biosecurity expert argued that there's probably evidence that there's already been biosecurity lapses and bioengineered organisms have been deliberately released. The patterns of these infections don't match what you would expect from a natural evolution of an organism. Do you agree with that?
You know, I have not seen any specific evidence to that effect yet where we can actually say there's a big gap in how this organism looks from a genetic standpoint that could not be explained by an evolutionary process. But I can't say that it hasn't happened, and I surely would never say that it's not going to happen. I think that's the challenge we have before us today. And of course, you know, this is where, as a world, we have to look at this as a worldwide problem. You know, it's far too often that a crisis happens in the Middle East or it happens somewhere in some other foreign country, and they're so far away from us, we don't even think about it. You know, bombs dropped in Syria are not going to be a bomb dropped in Sydney. But when you talk about an infectious disease, a germ somewhere in the world can be anywhere in the world today. And that's, I think, the challenge we have is that it does matter to us what happens in any of the continents of the world, because it's almost a guarantee most of these infectious agents will show up in all continents.
So we've now scared the proverbial out of our listener. What solutions are there, if any? I mean, I think in a previous book you've talked about a 9-point battle plan. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is the plan here, if there is indeed a plan?
Well, first of all, this is why if there's anything that should unite us as a human race, it's the fight against the microbes. We're all in this together. It's almost like as if it were Martians coming to invade the world and take us over. We should all be together on that one. So I think this is where cooperation and collaboration is critical. If a country is aware that a certain laboratory has purchased recently chemicals that would suggest they're doing some kind of work that could potentially be suspicious, then that has to be known to a number of different nations in terms of their law enforcement and their follow-up, because these people have to be followed. These people have to be carefully vetted in terms of what their risk is.
These are not metal tubes for a centrifuge to spin down uranium. I mean, this is microscopic stuff.
Yeah, this is, well, but for example, if you want to order amino acids, certain building blocks that we use to build a microbe, you can order them today. Think of a house where instead of building it board by board, it comes in pieces. One wall's done, one part of the ceiling's done, and you assemble it together. And so most laboratories today would not go out and buy just single amino acids and try to put them together. They'll actually buy certain genetic strings and certain products. So that today, one of the challenges we have is how do we track purchases that are made that could be suggestive of that someone has an intent to do something with this microbe that otherwise is not what we want them to do, is nefarious. And so I think that's what we're trying to do today, is get the world to come together. The second thing is we need to be prepared to help anyone in the world who has a problem. If smallpox emerges in India, or if smallpox emerges in France, or the United States, or Australia, or Ghana, we should be there immediately as a world to help squelch that, to put it out before it starts to spread. We can say that that is good politics, it's good human aid kind of things. It's actually smart. Because
it's not working in the Congo with Ebola at the moment.
Well, you know, and that's an example where, and I'm glad you raised that, because for a lot of infectious diseases around the world, we will have the populations supportive. But, you know, you take a look at what's happening in the DRC, in the northeastern part of that country, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the ongoing Ebola outbreak is tied to disbelief in the government, to suspicions that, in fact, this is an event that's being perpetrated on the population. And so we've had this noncompliance, this unwillingness to help. We've had clinics attacked. We've had healthcare workers killed. We've had equipment destroyed. So you're right. Now, on the other hand, you know, you've got an outbreak right now, which I think is the saddest commentary on the human condition that I have had in my career. We have had millions of individuals in Yemen develop cholera because of a war going on over there, where we've basically been bombing that country into submission in terms of the rebels. Now, you can argue that, I'm not here to argue politics, I don't know enough to do that, but I know when you have hundreds of thousands of young starving children developing cholera because they don't have safe water, we have vaccines and we have treatments that we could bring into them, they're being withheld. That's really, really a challenge for me. And so I think you're right. The world isn't just one safe place where if an infectious disease happens, we'll run in and shut it down. But that should be our goal. We should be trying to do that, to say that we're all in it against the bugs. That's what we're trying to do.
And what about regulating the technology? And indeed, what America is starting to do is regulating or restricting who comes into labs to learn these technologies.
I think that's a very reasonable approach today, given the potential damage that just one release of one of these infectious agents could do. And this is publicly known, so I'm surely not giving bad guys ideas. But we know today that if someone were to take a basic old crop duster plane that they would use in normal agricultural practice, today grow up large volumes of Bacillus anthracis, the bacteria that causes anthrax, which is readily available because we have it occurring naturally in the wild, and you can just basically go and culture an animal that's recently died from anthrax and get that. And the challenge with that is that today we have dual technologies. For example, the bacteria that we use to fight mosquitoes is Bacillus thuringiensis, a kissing cousin of Bacillus anthracis. We grow that up by many, many pounds to release into the environment to kill mosquitoes. So now suddenly somebody does that. They could take out all of Manhattan, and we would not know how to remediate that for years and years to come. Many, many, many thousands of people would die. And what would happen to Wall Street? So the consequences of these kinds of releases cannot be overstated. People say you're just scaring the hell out of us. Don't say that. That's just not the case. These are real high consequence events. And so one of the things we work on is just that. One, how do you prevent them from happening? How, tracking someone who might be making anthrax spores. Number two is, how do you basically make sure they don't have the equipment to release it? Whatever, that's tough if it's spraying equipment that you use in agriculture. And third, what do we do to treat people? And how do we remediate the environment if these things get released? So these are huge challenges that we're working on all the time. It's just that most people don't want to believe they're going to happen. And so the support is at best, oh, don't worry about it.
And just finally, again, at that conversation we had recently, it was suggested that the US and other countries are much better at early surveillance for potentially new organisms than Australia is. Do you feel Australia is a laggard when it comes to actually watching for these kinds of organisms?
I can't say that they're a laggard at all. You know, in terms of the surveillance activities here, a term we use to know what's going on in laboratories, how well testing is being done, is it getting reported or not, I think that Australia surely has distinguished itself in being able to detect influenza and new emerging influenza strains. You're in the middle of a very serious influenza seasonal outbreak right now. We all can do better, but I don't have any evidence that Australia is behind the curve. I think if there's any term I'd apply, we're all a little bit behind the curve in terms of being able to rapidly detect and rapidly respond to a major release. I think even the United States is not really ready for that.
So let's not fall asleep at the wheel.
Yeah, I think the message here is to stay vigilant. The bugs were here before us, the bugs are here while we're here, and the bugs are going to be here after we're gone. And our job is to not lose the fight on our watch with those bugs.
Michael Osterholm, thanks very much for joining us on the Health Report.
Thank you.
Michael Osterholm is Director of the Centre for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He's also the Science Envoy for the US State Department for Global Health Security. I'm Norman Swan. This has been the Health Report. And for the next three Mondays, your host on the Health Report is going to be the Health Report's producer, James Bullen. He'll be fantastic. See you later.